Yeah, we're live tonight, and tonight we're talking with Mr. Dale Kaczmarek again. And how you doing, Dale?
Yep. I'm doing great.
That's good. That's good. See, Dale's the guy we get to go to because he's been doing this since the 1970s with investigations and stuff. And he's got a pretty extensive list of things that probably do's and don'ts, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like night and day from when I first started to what it is today, with the how the paranormal has changed so much. Not just, methodologies and investigative techniques, but just the equipment, which was non-existent pretty much when I started. There was really nothing. I started off with a cassette tape recorder, a 35-millimeter camera, and my magnetometer or my EMF meter was a compass. Because compasses should point to true magnetic north unless they come in contact with a very strong magnetic field, in which case the needle might deviate a little bit to wherever the magnetic field is. I mean, you could possibly have a ghost. There could be other explanations for that.
Right.
You're like night and day. I think a lot of the success for my group and myself and other people maybe in the field, we have to kind of thank your motion pictures for that a lot too. I mean, Ghostbusters, for instance, had a big radical change in people's viewpoints before.
Right.
And even things like the very early shows like That's Incredible, Real People, Unsolved Mysteries, Sightings.
Yeah, Ripley's Believe It or Not. That's another one that could be contributed.
True great shows that didn't ask you to do anything fake or anything. They just wanted to see what you did, and something showed up. It was an extra for the show.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, I loved working with those. I worked with Sightings several times. In fact, I was the only, I hate to ring my own bell here, but I was the only paranormal investigator ever allowed to investigate Gettysburg at night, legally, all night with the park rangers and the Sightings team.
That's pretty cool. Awesome. and probably not going to be able to do that ever again, right?
Well, actually, no, there is a kind of a no ghost policy, in most state battlefields, national battlefields, now state parks, they don't like to perpetuate the legend. So if there is a story about a ghost, they just say, well, that's just, somebody made that up. It's not really true. Or, they might just kind of poo-poo it, but the thing was that, going to places like Gettysburg or Battlefield, you can technically be there after dark because some of these battlefields close at 10 o'clock.
Right.
So you can be out there. And you can do an investigation during the daytime, too. But there's so many people at these battlefields, especially Gettysburg. I know a lot of real obscure locations on the battlefield, which are extremely haunted. And people just don't know about that much. So we can kind of get off the beaten trail, so to speak, and do an investigation out there without really being disturbed. So you go out there, say, in a summer evening. I mean, you don't have that much light because maybe the sun goes down about, 8:45.
Right.
About an hour and 15 minutes. But say you go there during the wintertime, if you can brave the, brave the cold. Sun's going down at like 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the afternoon.
Right.
5 o'clock. You got like 5 hours to do an investigation. So it really depends if you're kind of that bold person that wants to get out there and brave the weather a little bit.
Not at my age.
Joe's one that can't. Me, on the other hand, I guarantee you I can.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got enough. I got enough padding, enough insulation here to keep me warm.
We have done a lot of investigating, actually, believe it or not, in places where it was very cold. One place that comes to mind was Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in Weston, West Virginia. We were there, I believe, in January or February, and they have a kind of like they call a warmth room, like a hot room, basically, kind of heated up to keep the kid, kind of get you kind of like, you know, the shivers away from you. Then you go back out into the building again. But I mean, it was literally like a room inside there. It was cold. It was damp. You could see your breath, which was, you know, making it kind of hard for some photography. You'd have to hold your breath so you didn't make sure you didn't photograph your own breath coming out of your mouth and think it was a ghost later on. And we've done a lot of outside investigations too, that we've been in places where it's been kind of, you know, the weather's been kind of inclement. So, I prefer doing it, obviously, in the warmer weather myself.
I'm with you on that one. Hey, somebody here said that they just saw you talking about the White House being haunted. Can't remember the channel, though.
Yeah, that was a travel
channel. White House is haunted?
That was World's Most Haunted on the Travel Channel. It was just on, a couple days ago, April 7th. See, most of those paranormal shows have went to Discovery Plus. I want to give a plug there, which is a shame because I like to watch some of those programs, not so much because of what people were doing, but where they went and what kind of equipment they used. So I was quite lucky to get on this show from this called Peninsula Film from the UK. A guy came all the way from the UK, was a producer, and put together this whole series called World's Most Unexplained. And they did everything from, you know, Elvis to ghosts to psychics to, you know kind of like Bigfoot stuff, cryptids, and everything, which is really, really neat. I did an excellent job. And I was actually supposed to be on three different episodes. He wanted me to be on the episode about Flight 191 that crashed in Chicago. And that actually was on earlier that same day. I mean, I was on twice within 2 hours. I was on at 11 o'clock in the morning talking about Flight 191. And then at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Central Standard Time, that is, I was talking about the ghost of the White House. They had also interviewed me when I was here because there was another one about Elvis's ghost, Elvis Presley's ghost. And I actually had talked about that and gave, you know, some of my opinions about it and, you know, some interesting photographs that people had taken, including this one woman that had actually, she was wearing basically kind of like a blouse that had nothing on it, you know, just kind of a white blouse. Mm-hmm. And somebody took a picture of her in the, you know, like, hey, here I am, you know, even though I guess you're not really supposed to take pictures. And they didn't use a flash, so they didn't get caught. And when I looked at the picture later, there was the face of Elvis right on her blouse. It was unmistakable. And it wasn't like she said it wasn't an Elvis Presley souvenir T-shirt or anything like that. She was wearing nothing, you know, just a plain white blouse, and something showed up on there. That's, and it was all kind of other things that talked about, you know, Elvis and whether or not he's actually, you know, dead, because actually his middle name was misspelled on his grave.
There's a lot of theories on that.
Nobody accepted the flag at the funeral, but yet he was in the service because he did serve in Germany, and then
stationed, you know, in Hawaii.
You're talking to an expert and the conspiracy of all those conspiracies that surround Elvis Presley. You're talking to an expert.
Yeah. Joe's one of the few around that know pretty much everything to know about Elvis.
You know, I remember the day he supposedly died, you know, in 77. I was 10 years old, and my mom and her two sisters and my Aunt Mary and somebody else was there, and they were just sitting around that Christmas or the kitchen table drinking their coffee, you know, doing their woman thing. And then all of a sudden it comes over the air that he passed away at the age of 42, you know, and they just started bawling, and it just floored me. I couldn't understand why they were bawling so bad somebody that he'd never met before.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't family. It wasn't, and they were just like bawling like it was their brother or their sister or their daughter or somebody like that that passed away. You know, so I couldn't understand why. And then after that, I kind of got obsessed with him and his music and been studying him ever since.
Yeah. Well, that's like when I was in fourth grade in, I think, 1964. I apparently it got came to school a little bit late that day for some reason. You know, I was late a lot, even though I was one of the people blocking school. I wasn't playing hooky, by the way. I just didn't, you know, go to school. I was always on time. And I got into the classroom, and everybody's crying. I go, "What's going on?" And they said, "Didn't you hear? John Kennedy was assassinated."
Yep.
Holy, yep. The president?
Here, but,
and all, the, with, all the girls are crying, and they're trying to console them, and you know they had the counselors inside there and everything, and that was just, you know, utterly amazing.
Another person with a lot of conspiracy around him.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, the Kennedy family in general has a lot of conspiracy around it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just JFK. Yeah. You got Robert and all of them. They had a lot of conspiracy.
Well, I mean, I call it the curse of the Kennedys. Look what they went through.
Oh, yeah. They went through hell.
John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, mm-hmm. JFK Jr., the little boy that was saluting his father. When the casket went around, and his wife and a couple of others drowned. But they lost control of an airplane, and they drowned. And yeah, I mean, there's all kind of, you know, ideas that there's some sort of curse on the Kennedys.
Well, yeah, Ted Kennedy even believed it because they wanted him to run for president and stuff.
He wouldn't do it.
I don't think so. Nope. And he kept.
He refused. He refused. That is the reason he refused
to do it.
To run for presidents.
Yeah.
It's because of that. He thought there was a curse.
If you got both of your brothers already assassinated, you know, that's a signal they didn't want you. They didn't want the Kennedys in office.
No, right. Because the Kennedys were a family that were well off, well to do. That were actually, they actually gave a crap about the people. They didn't care, right? They were about what was right, not right. How much money they could put in their pocket, like today's politicians are. But now we don't need to get off on politics. Damn you! I'm gonna blame him.
But just kind of getting back to Elvis for a second. I mean, you know, there were so many so many alleged photographs, I should say, that people have taken of him, and a lot of them unfortunately appeared in somebody's tabloids, like the National Enquirer and so forth.
One of the most famous
Elvis.
Well, one of the most famous
sunglasses and so forth.
Right, but one of the most famous pictures that somebody supposedly took was him in the pool house at
Memory Gardens.
Yeah.
In Memory Gardens. They were visiting Memory Gardens, and you could see the pool in the background from where they took the picture, and there was a figure that you could see through the screen door.
And they thought that is supposedly Elvis.
Elvis sitting there watching everybody honor him at his own headstone.
Yeah.
But he wasn't even buried there then.
Here's a good trivia question here for you, Joe. Who was Elvis Presley's bodyguard?
Which one?
Well, his main one.
I mean, there was like, there was a whole Memphis Mafia. There was like Joe I can't even pronounce his name, Espedito.
Yeah.
And then there was the two brothers, Red West and Sonny West. They were part of his crew. And I can't remember the other names.
His main bodyguard, if you remember that, when Elvis was on stage, you know, towards the end, you know, he started to lose it a little bit. And he actually started doing karate moves and everything and kicking and everything. Well, he actually was taught by Ed Parker.
Right.
Ed Parker was the master of Kempo. The master. That's as high as you can go.
Elvis had a black belt.
And there's many pictures of him walking off stage or walking on stage, and Ed Parker's right behind him. And nobody's going to get past Ed Parker. Now, interesting story. I actually, in my 20s, I took several years of Kempo karate. I ended up being almost an orange belt. It had a yellow belt with orange tips, which is like right next to being an orange belt. That was pretty good, actually. I went to a couple tournaments. I beat a couple people. I didn't go very far in the tournament. But there was a surprise in one of these tournaments. Ed Parker shows up. I go, oh, my God. I mean, the guy that knows everything about karate, Kempo. So he was actually coming up to the students, and you would able to do a maneuver against Ed Parker. He would ask you, well, what do you want to do? And I said, clutching feathers. And clutching feathers, not to be real technical, but somebody grabs your hair, you grab their hair, you extend your arm out, and then you take your fist like this, and you go right into his, arm.
Pressure point
is going to release it, and then you swipe it away like this. Mm-hmm. And I did that to Ed Parker. Ed Parker grabbed my hair, and I swiped it away, and he just said, well, make sure next time you really swipe it away. You really get that hand away from me real quick. Carry it out. I was pretty good. And I got an autographed picture of him. He had a big poster, and it says, to Dale, Ed Parker, blah, 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 whatever he said on there. And he's gone now. He's no longer with us. But that was such an amazing trip. I mean, I know it's far being off the ghost thing, but I mean, it's just something we got kind of talking about Elvis, and just a thrill meeting Ed Parker. I mean.
Oh, yeah. Anytime you meet someone like that, it's a thrill. It's to me, it's an honor to be able to meet people like that. Right. So, but anyway,
want to talk some ghosts?
So, what's new with you? What have you been up to since we last talked?
Well, I've been actually doing a lot of what I call little scouting trips around this, all around the area of where I live. Okay. Far on the northwest side, far western suburbs, far south suburbs, just going to locations I've never been to before, kind of scoping them out for possible investigations for our team up here in the future, to see which ones we could legitimately do and legally do, trespass at any locations we go to. So I found this really neat place in Chicago called the Reed Dunning Memorial Park. Now, interesting story about this. Very fascinating story how this became what it is today. Back in roughly about between 1805 or so is when the first commercial cemetery in Chicago was started, and that was due to Fort Dearborn, the Fort Dearborn Cemetery, which was actually located on the south side of Chicago River. Between Lake Street and Wabash in that area. It's roughly about 300 North Michigan. That's about where the fort would, and just a few hundred feet further south, the cemetery would have been. And of course, Fort Dearborn stayed around. It was part of the Fort Dearborn Massacre, where the Indians came and they were trying to get out to the safety of Fort Wayne, Indiana. And they were massacred literally at the corner between 16th and Indiana and 18th and Prairie, which is today known as Massacre Site or Massacre Tree. And very fascinating story. So fast forward maybe about three decades, Chicago becomes Chicago in 1833. Well, obviously, the fort's no longer there, and they got to do something, with these bodies that are in the cemetery. Instead of just building over them or like removing the headstones like in the movie Poltergeist, they moved them to City Cemetery in Lincoln Park, where the Lincoln Park Zoo is today. And that basically, they call it the old City Cemetery, but it was actually a conglomeration of about seven smaller cemeteries, including a Jewish cemetery, a Catholic cemetery, a pauper cemetery. So they were put in there, and so they were moved from Fort Dearborn to the City Cemetery. Now, fast forward about a couple more decades later, again, urban renewal was happening. That cemetery, you know, City of Chicago doesn't want a cemetery within the confines of the City of Chicago at that point. So again, they start to contact people to see whether or not they can have permission to move the bodies to someplace else.
Okay.
The ones they couldn't find, they simply removed the headstones and they left the bodies in there because they just couldn't move them without permission. If you're familiar with Lincoln Park and you're familiar with the Lincoln Park Zoo, there is a field house. And there, right next to the field house are several baseball diamonds. It's right where those baseball diamonds are today. There may be as many as 18,000 graves that are still there.
Wow.
People that basically had no headstone. They were buried in unmarked graves. They were indigent. So they all had to be moved again to an area near Irving Park Road in Narragansett, which was called it has several names, but it eventually became known as the Dunning Asylum, that was started in about 1854. That's the physical building. And then later on, when people began dying, you know, and this was not just for crazy people. This was people that couldn't take care of themselves, they were homeless. They were unwed mothers. They were poor people. If you didn't have a place to go, you went there. So when people started dying off, they started burying them around the property in unmarked graves as well. Because, you know, they didn't have any money to erect stones for everybody.
Right,
so what happened then, okay, now this is back in the 1860s, 1870s. Now fast forward until about, you know, almost a whole century later, in 1989, they are trying to build a whole bunch of buildings in that area. That property was sold to the city. It ended up being, I'm guessing about 100 acres or so. And they were going to build part of a residential area, and then further back, you know, towards where the old Dunning Asylum was. Of course, they didn't know that at the time. They were going to build some stores and strip malls and stuff like that over there. Then they start digging up bones. And thousands of bones are dug up. So they had to stop right away because anytime you dig up bones, it could be a crime scene. They don't know.
Right. So it's a law that's not.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So now they go. Now they start to do some research, go back in old city maps, and lo and behold, right where they're digging is the Dunning Asylum and the Dunning Cemetery. So think of it. Those people that were originally at Fort Dearborn were moved to the city cemetery, to Dunning, and then accidentally dug up a third time. No, a third time, where this was accidental digging them. So what they did is they took all those bodies and parts of bodies, because again, they weren't buried in, you know, they were just buried in pine boxes.
Right.
This place is called the Reed Dunning Memorial Park. And there basically is about 36,000 graves or remains of people in this little, you know, section of land. And I walked it. I actually posted some of the pictures up about this, I believe. If I haven't, I'm going to. I can't remember. But there are sections in there, which is really amazing. They have a section for just orphan children. They have a section for the poor, the indigent. They even have 118 victims that could never be identified from the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. Uh-oh. Buried in there as well.
Wow.
They got Civil War people from the Civil War that some obviously could not... it could not be identified. So all these people that are in there are unidentified. Because if they were identified, they would have been buried, you know, properly, you know, with a memorial cemetery where people could come and visit. So they just buried all the people there. And, you know, there has been reports in the neighborhood, as you might imagine, of some kind of paranormal activity going on. And obviously, you know,
I wonder why.
One of the main things in cemeteries, and I tell people all the time, that most cemeteries are not haunted. Because think of it this way. If you died and came back as a ghost, where would you want to hang out?
Probably not. You don't want to hang out where you're buried.
But if you're constantly being disturbed, your remains are being disturbed. I mean, is there a physical connection still between the soul of the person and their physical remains? I will never know. But it seems that there has been either desecration, purposeful desecration, like in Bachelor's Grove, or other cemeteries, or accidental, as in the Dumming Asylum, Greenwood Cemetery out in Decatur, which used to be a Civil War section until a massive flood came through the area and washed all those remains down the hill, battered them all over.
And people
have been seeing strange lights on the hill. So I always tell people that's one of the main things that why cemeteries are haunted is if you disturb the dead. And this is one of the places I've been exploring, hoping to get back to with our team. I think we should be able to do it because it's not really a cemetery per se. It's not a forest preserve. It's really right in the middle of a residential neighborhood on Belle Plaine in Chicago with homes all the way around. And you got suddenly this big section of green land with this beautiful markers in front there and bronze plaques at all the stations, you know, talking about what happened, what transpired, the transfer of the graves, and who's all buried here.
You know, while you were talking about this, I was looking some stuff up here on maps. And I'm looking at Schuyler Park area. And that's close to where you were telling me, or where you were telling us here. There are a ton of cemeteries around O'Hare Airport.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's why there's a lot of also paranormal activity around O'Hare Airport that you hear a lot.
No, I'm counting already like a dozen that I've found.
Well,
just around O'Hare.
If you remember, they actually paved over a cemetery, St. Joseph's Cemetery. They told them that they wanted to build another runway, and unfortunately, the runway was going to go right through the cemetery. So they contacted who they could to try to get, you know, not so much permission. They kind of claimed eminent domain. And they said, we're going to use this land, and unfortunately, we got to find a place to move these bodies. And if you can't move them, we're just going to pave over them pretty much.
I don't think I'd want to be on a plane that would be touching down on the runway.
Yeah.
Well, was that on the north or south end of the airport?
I'm going to say probably the southwest, southeast corner, if I remember correctly. I believe it was called St. Joseph Cemetery. I believe it was called that. I have some pictures of it. There was a big hullabaloo in the papers about that because people didn't want their family and friends disturbed. And they picketed, you know, they went to their Congress people, they went to the city council and tried to stop it. And, you know, money talks and bullshit walks.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, the reason I'm asking, I'm actually looking at a diagram of the airport, and there's a full runway on the south end. There's a full runway on the north end, and also on the south end, there's another runway that's angled, running southeast to northwest.
Yeah.
So,
if you just Google something about O'Hare Airport Cemetery, you'll pull up all the different reports and newspaper articles about that. And it might be more specific exactly where it is. But another strange thing that I noticed when I was in the midst of putting together some ghost tours for the Lincoln Park Zoo, which unfortunately never transpired because of certain people that wanted it for themselves. And but anyway, one of the places that was haunted was there were a number of buildings on the property, and one of the buildings on the south end of the property was the farm and the zoo, as they call it. There's actually a farm down there with animals and barns, and show you what farm animals look like. And when they were digging the foundation for that barn, and then part of it became also kind of like an indoor exhibit area. Dr. Lester Fisher, does that name ring a bell to anybody?
Heard that name before.
He was the guy that was on the Ray Rayner show in the morning.
Yep, I used to watch that show.
And he was the curator of the Lincoln Park Zoo. They used to call
right.
It had that strange song, Green Alligators and Long Neck Geese. And that was a kind of a theme song for that. Well,
you're making me feel old. That show hasn't been around in years.
You're showing my age there. But he was there when this was going on, when they were building this new addition to the zoo. And they came across dozens and dozens of remains. And he said he called the Chicago Police Department on numerous occasions. This is true. This was going to be part of my tour. I did a lot of research, and in fact, I actually surprised the Lincoln Park Zoo of how much I came across. But he said that on several occasions, he called the Chicago Police to report bodies found in there, and they never came. They just never came. Because after a while, it's like, hey, you're expected to find bodies over here because this used to be a cemetery. So go right ahead. So what they did is they just concreted over these bodies, and put the foundation down for this indoor exhibit area. And that's one of the areas in the Lincoln Park Zoo that's extremely haunted because, again, you got remains being disturbed.
Right.
That
makes a lot of sense.
There's a lot of
go back a little bit further than that, say around the 1860s, there was a place in Blue Island, which was called the Old Blue Island Cemetery. Now, not a lot of people know about it today, but it's called Memorial Park in Blue Island. And we've actually been able to do some investigations down there. I was able to talk with the village president, the village vice president, and the entire board of directors. They brought us in to a room, kind of a conference room, myself and my research assistant, Jim Graychuk, and started to tell us about some of these things that were going on, because as they were digging for water fountains and sewer systems and pavement and just trails through there, they were coming up with just an enormous amount of bones. Now, again, they didn't know. Again, this happens with history. History gets lost sometimes. They didn't know that they were actually on property that was a city cemetery. And he showed me all types of tombstones they found. They found, there's reports, if you actually Google bodies found in Memorial Park or something like that on Google search, you'll find exactly what I'm talking about. They found a part of a skull and a femur in the slope going down to the football field. And there has been reports of strange lights that people have seen. The field house itself is haunted. Fred Bellotto, who was the village president at the time for the park district, told me that when he was very young, and he was kind of what you call a gopher, go for this, go for that,
Right.
He was downstairs in the building by himself, making some extra money, sweeping up, emptying garbage cans, wiping down stuff, by himself. He had the keys to everything. Then he heard the door open from upstairs. He said, no, I locked that door. And he hears footsteps coming towards the room. Now, the only way to get back is to go right past and through where the footsteps are coming from. It's one way in and one way out. And suddenly the footsteps stopped, he said. He didn't know what was going on. He stopped what he was doing, turned the light on. He ran like a bat out of, you know what, out of that front door and locked up. And he told me about that. And he told me that story. I began telling him some stories I had come across. I did a presentation at the nearby Blue Island Library, and I talked about this. And afterwards, several people who lived right on the fringe of the cemetery, which are now houses around there on the east and the south side of the cemetery, told me about strange things that are happening in their house. Footsteps, apparitions, shadow figures. I did some research exactly where these houses are today. Yeah. Was originally part of the cemetery. It was a much larger cemetery. So again, people being disturbed out there.
Right.
I told them the story and they're shaking their heads. They already had heard this from people in the village. There was a house not too far from there near the Blue Island Police Department, part of a series of homes that they would do walk through to show you the old architecture of the buildings. And when the people that went into this one, building, they weren't going to be taking them upstairs because it was too much for the seniors to walk up and down there, so they just showed them the downstairs. And as they're getting ready to leave, a couple of people said, "Well, aren't we going to go upstairs?" And there's a woman in period costume up there, kind of telling us to come on up, beckoning for us to come up. And, The other docent says, "There ain't nobody in the house but us and me. There ain't nobody upstairs. What did you see?" As I'm telling this story, again, all of them are bowing their heads like this in unison because they heard that story. So it's really strange. And I can go on and on and on and on of cemeteries where either people forgot they were cemeteries, or in case of bachelors, girl people going out there purposely digging up bodies. Strange paranormal activity happens afterwards. I think there may be a connection between some kind of connection between your earthly remain and maybe your physical body today.
Oh, there absolutely could be. I mean, we are a vessel for what's inside. We're the vessel holding the spirit within, and then when we pass on and our bodies get to that point where they can no longer sustain and it releases that spirit, I actually believe that there is a part of that spirit still attached to the remains of your physical being, because depending on the length of time that you've lived, it's only logical that there would be a little bit of residue there to keep it connected. But yeah, that's a interesting stuff there for the Chicago area.
Cemeteries, though, that happened to all over the place, not just there.
Well, Chicago is a huge city, and over the years, over the many of years, you've got it growing and expanding and pushing, and of course they're going to have to try and figure out ways of accommodating. And if they've got huge cemeteries like that, are they really going to make the expenditure to move everything?
Yeah.
Good.
I can see where a lot of that gets overlooked that way.
Yeah, but think about it. Every time something like that gets disturbed, especially without the permission
of the
family or something like that, it leaves behind a lot of bad juju. Look what happened. Look at the main story of Aztalan State Park.
I know.
About
the Indian princesses.
Right. They dug up the remains and put them in a museum in Milwaukee, and to this day they still sit in storage in that museum in Milwaukee. But if you go to her burial mound in that state park and you stand there, you'll hear her shell belts rattling behind you. When you turn around, nobody's there.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. or if you want to talk about, you know, graveyards, or at least, you know, places where people were put. I mean, just think of all the atrocities that went on at the John Wayne Gacy home.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
On Somerdale, there were at least 29 bodies that they found on the property, another four that he disposed of.
Weren't they found under the house?
29 bodies found under the house. I think a couple might have been found also under the garage floor and a driveway. I have every single article from day one from Gacy right up to today, and they're still talking about Gacy. I think they're trying to do some sort of special about it.
Yeah.
And the usual thing about, you know, that location is that you know, they were finding them when they first went in the crawl space. You know, they just saw these mounds. You know, they easily see that there was probably somebody buried here.
Yeah.
But they found more and more. They wondered, well, since he's a construction worker, did he also have lure people to his construction sites and then maybe kill him and bury him under concrete someplace else too? So they tried to find locations where he had worked, see if they could look at ground penetrating radar to see if the earth had been disturbed and possibly it'd be a body there. They were at one time going to dig the entire property down to a depth of 6 feet, the entire property, to see if they could find stuff. And they never did that for some reason. But I was there in I want to guess maybe 6 months or so after they tore the house down. So that probably was, sometime in 1980. I think it happened in 79 when he was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there with Richard Crowe, who's a pretty famous researcher in Chicago, more famous for his ghost tours. And I was there. I had two cameras with me that evening, one black and white high-speed infrared film and one black and white high-speed just ordinary Tri-X film, just ordinary black and white film. Mm-hmm. And I had them on a tripod, and I was just snapping pictures. Snap, turn the camera, snap, turn the camera. Until I exhausted the 36 rolls, 36 pictures on film. And then when I got the film back, I compared all the pictures because the cameras are basically, almost piggyback next to one another. So you pretty much almost get
right.
The exact same field of vision. And I tried to snap them exactly at the same time. And then I would compare them. And it was amazing. We caught some strange stuff in there, which leads me to believe that there were still bodies there. We saw, now this is going back into the 70s and 80s where a lot of people were catching these orbs, mm-hmm. but I got them, they're moving, and they only show up in the infrared film. They don't show up on the high speed film taken at the very same time. So if they were bugs, they were insects, they were dust particles, they were some-
They should have showed up.
It should have showed up on both cameras.
Yep.
It only showed up on the infrared. And I have three pictures in sequence that actually shows these kind of weird, kind of globular, massive little shapes kind of moving around in a certain area. From where the picture was taken, it was pretty darn close to where his driveway used to be. And they wanted to tear up his entire driveway and look underneath that too. And they never did.
They should have.
The unusual thing, as you know, that property was sold. Somebody else has moved in. They knew the history. They were told the history in advance. They got the property with what they said was a song and a dance. And I guess nothing has happened. I mean, kind of hard just to go up to somebody's door, knock on the door and say, oh, by the way, you got any paranormal activity going on here?
Yeah.
I have not heard anything. Well,
knowing the history of the property.
Exactly. I mean, I would venture a guess that something's happening on there.
But then people can be oblivious to that because, there is, they can walk around with blinders on and not even notice anything like that.
True.
I mean, it's possible. Like I said, anything's possible. But I would imagine today, if somebody else didn't buy that property, maybe somebody more willing, somebody should go in there with today's technology and the ground penetrating radar and x-ray and stuff and actually see if there's stuff there. Because, I mean, that's where it started. That's where he started, because they didn't catch him until he was living in Iowa.
Yeah, I mean, closer to you guys, your guy neck of the woods. I mean, you had Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh,
and not just Dahmer. We had Gacy up here too.
Yeah, and you got to remember, he lived in an apartment complex.
Oh yeah, I know where that apartment complex is. We drove by there about 2 days, 2 or 3 days after it after they caught him, you know, and after he was arrested. And they still had it all taped off as like a crime scene and stuff. And it was right around the time that the state fair was going on, which wasn't too far away. I mean, where his apartment was in the state fair, it's just a matter of blocks. You know,
well, not just that. He also worked at that chocolate factory.
That just, you know, I mean, that's one sick individual right there.
Yeah, you know, there's all kinds of weird crap.
And I think that the Milwaukee police brought one of his victims back to him.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, am I correct in my research that Carpen Complex was torn down?
No, it's still there.
It's still there.
Okay. Last I knew, that apartment complex was still there when we drove through there. And we were actually in down on that road about 5 or 6 years ago.
Do you know the address to it?
Not right off, but I know.
I don't either. But I do know a guy named John Borowski. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he did write several books on all types of mass murderers and kind of devious themes. Son of Sam, Ted Bundy, all these different people, Gacy, Dahmer, the guy that was skinning people up there in Wisconsin.
Don't forget about the Plainsfield killer.
Yeah, and he would be the one to ask that question. I mean, I had heard, maybe it's just folklore, that somebody had told me that they had torn that apartment complex down. And they were never going to build anything on it again.
Well, they might have since the last time I was there, but when I was there that one time, it was still standing.
Now, I found the place.
I do remember there was talks about tearing it down, and then just leaving it an empty lot.
Yeah.
You know, like having grass grow over it and maybe plant a tree or two, but that's all I knew, As far as I can tell, the last time I was there, and it could have been longer than 6 years ago that I was down that road.
I don't know. According to the satellite image I just brought up, it's still standing there.
Okay.
918 North 25th Street.
Well, there's a place in Chicago that also had a Dahmer connection. There was a place called Carol's Place. We were contacted by the owner. And found out about this because this was apparently one of the locations where Jeffrey Dahmer had lured one of his victims from this gay bar.
And that was his MO.
Yeah. So we were trying to get in to investigate because we were told immediately by the owner that he had sold the building and he was getting out anyway. So I said, well, why not let us in? Let us get in because it's not going to disturb any business you got in the future because you've already sold the property. And he kind of reneged a little bit and kind of back and forth. And then one day one of my research people from the group went past there and took a picture and he said, "You're not going to believe this. Here's what's left of the place. It's an empty lot. They tore it down to the ground."
Wow.
And I go, That kind of made me even a bit angry because I said, well, wait a second. I mean, you could have let us go in there if you're going to tear the building down completely.
Well, yeah.
But see, the thing about that, I mean, it's not just buildings that are haunted. It could be the properties, what you call stigmatized property. places that have a stigma, have had violent, untimely death associated with them. No matter what you build on that property, something's going to happen. A very good example happened in Chicago at what was initially called Frank Gift's Bar, 5900 North Broadway, owned by Frank Gift. Now, he used to, he was the owner, and he used to, like, sample his wares a lot at night. And he said one evening he must have just stumbled, hit his head on the floor, and laid there and died behind the bar. So eventually, you know, they sold the bar. It became the Edinburgh Castle Inn. Jane McDougal, believe it or not, was the owner of that place. I was in there, and she said that, you know, they changed the inside a little bit, which is another thing that often, you know, makes ghosts angry when you start changing stuff. Right. They removed part of that bar, and they put some tables, like, what do you call them, like, they're like tables with cushions on them, around them, and so forth. And
booths?
Booths, thank you. That's what I was trying to say, booths.
No, that's fine.
And people right over there that used to sit in that booth used to say that they would feel something, especially women, tugging on their skirts, their legs, their feet, feel a cold draft all the time, just exactly where he died. Now, eventually it was sold and it became Pancho's Place. So it went from being a probably the only Scottish bar in Chicago to being a Mexican restaurant. And they changed stuff inside there, and stuff happened, and they were only in there for 1 year. It was eventually called the St. Andrew's Inn, and now it's called the Old St. Andrew's Inn. It went through so many different people. No matter what they did, no matter what they tried to change, things always happened in that same place. So I don't think it was so much that the place was haunted as it was the property actually was haunted.
Right.
And see, there's a lot of places. You know, Chicago is probably one of the most interesting places with a lot of history for shit like that. I hate to say it, but it's true. I mean, you know, I was just thinking, I was sitting here thinking, talking about all this stuff, you know, and mass killings and stuff like this happening on property. And I had to sit back and think, and I was right. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre happened on the north side of Chicago. Yeah. Now that property's got to be extremely. That was a garage.
2122 North Clark Street.
Right.
Which was the site of the old SMC Carter's Company garage, the headquarters of Bugs Moran, the north side gang leader. Right. And, obviously Capone wanted to rub out all his competition. So he decided to scope out the area from a building across the street. And they watched the comings and goings of these gang people, so they knew what they looked like. And they wanted to wipe them out in all one fell swoop. Now, unfortunately, there was a guy, I believe his name was, I always get this wrong, so if I get the name wrong, forgive me. But he was a gangster groupie. I believe his name was Alan Weinshank. And he was a gangster groupie. He just liked to hang around with gangsters, okay? But he bore a striking resemblance to Bugs Moran, the boss. So when they saw him go in, they thought that they had the gang leader there too. They dressed up as plain clothes and uniformed police officers. They lined up against the wall, and they shot him point-blank range with 45 caliber Thompson submachine guns. Apparently, what they said, laced with garlic, to ensure that they would die from infection of some kind. I don't know if that's true.
Right.
That was one of the things that the gangsters often did. And that place has been it's just crazy. I mean, it was torn down, years after that, I think in 1959, I believe, if memory serves me correctly, as part of Mayor Daley's urban renewal project. people went up there and scarfed up bricks from the wall. Some actually stained with blood, some actually with bullet holes. And those people that had a large collection of bricks began to have a series of bad luck, including one guy that went through several divorces, had a heart attack, went bankrupt, went in the hospital several times, and started to say that he thought it was the bricks. He tried to get rid of them as quickly as he could. And there are some people still out there selling bricks. They want like $1,500, $2,000 for a brick that I can't really positively identify as
being right.
Some were taken to a bar called Tommy Guns on the north side, and they built what they had, kind of a recreation of that wall in their restaurant. And I think that's actually where some of those the untouchable ghost tours, the bus tours, they either start or leave from. But people going past that area, which is now basically a housing project for the elderly, on the south end of that housing project for the elderly, there's like a little park-like area, a little grassy area, and there's five trees, like the five spots of a playing card, or on a dice, you know. That center tree marks almost exactly where the north wall of that would have been. So if you stand near that center tree, you're standing just about where those men were shot down. People say they hear machine gun fire, automatic gunfire all the time. People with their animals, they go by and they say their animals will pull away, they'll whimper. Even canine dogs, a report by a Chicago police officer that told me that he was in an area trying to find a stop for drug search. And they use animals for that, as you know. And the animal got too close to the fence, and these highly trained animals are not supposed to react to something they don't see. But apparently a dog was seeing or experiencing something and started to pull back and basically, whimper about something that that dog was experiencing. Site of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
It's one of the bricks.
One of the bricks, yeah.
Site prior to its demolition.
Yeah, I was tempted to buy one for my collection, but I think $1,500 is a lot to buy for one. I mean, it was actually a documentary. This was probably back in, I would say, maybe the 1980s or 1990s. This gentleman was actually in the documentary. And I wish I would have caught it. Anyway, I saw it. This is before I even had a VCR to record it. He opened up his garage door and lined up along the inside of his garage were hundreds of bricks. And he said, these came from the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. They didn't care if I picked them up because they were going to dispose of them anyway. I mean, not knowing how maybe valuable they might have been to collectors and so forth, right, further on down the line. And he tried to get rid of them. You know, I think Richard Crowe picked up several of them himself and then tried to sell them for upwards of $1,000 and $800, $900, and nobody wanted to bite on that. They were supposedly given with certificates of authenticity that this was from the wall. But nowadays, you never know if somebody's trying to pull a con on you.
Well, that one from a museum, and then according to what I was reading, the rest, what remains of that, what besides that one brick, first one that was removed, that's still in that museum, the rest of them that they, I guess, were able to authenticate, are in a Bob Museum in Las Vegas.
Yeah, exactly.
On display.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things about St. Valentine's Day Massacre, including, again, like I say, the reason that they finally found out that there was something going on that day, February 14th, 1929, and they didn't pick it because it was Valentine's Day. That was just the day that they said, we're going in. It happened to be Valentine's Day. The way the police were brought to the scene was not because of the rat-a-tat-tat of machine gun fire, which people in Chicago had become used to at that time, all the time being
they were tipped off.
Different gangs killing off one another. It was the incessant barking of a dog named Highball, which was a German shepherd. And he was barking and crying and barking and barking and barking. And the neighbors complained about a dog barking. And they went in and they found the massacre. And so I often wonder, you know, Highball obviously is gone. That was 1929. He witnessed his friends being shot. Maybe he's still around, and maybe that's what these other real dogs are picking up, a ghostly dog there. But Frank Gusenberg, who was one of Pete and Frank Gusenberg were brothers, they were both killed there. He was a survivor from that just momentarily. He was rushed to a nearby Alexian Brothers hospital, and when he was rushed by police, "Who shot you?" His dying words said, "Nobody shot me." Even dying, he didn't want to give up on the mob, which was crazy.
That was loyalty, man.
The papers came out about this. Bugs Moran Bugs Moran was coming down the street that morning to go into the garage, and he saw what he thought was a bus. Police officers, uniform going in. He ducked into a nearby cafe, and he avoided being shot. He later stated in that that article from the, I think it was the Daily News at the time, that said, only Capone kills that way. And, of course, Capone was, sunning himself in Florida, and this was his henchman. Some say it could have been Machine Gun Jack McGurn. He loved machine guns. It could have been a very early, young Anthony Accardo, Tony Accardo, who later became a big mob boss figure further down the line. And Al Scalise was thought to be another one, but they never proved it. Nobody was ever caught for that. But it really was the downfall of the gangsters, because after that, seven people being killed, viciously, almost cut in half, that was enough for even the mayors and the judges who were kind of being paid off by the mob to say that was enough, and we can't be associated with you guys anymore. And eventually, as you know, Al Capone wasn't arrested for that. He was jailed for tax evasion.
Exactly. They got him for tax evasion.
That's what brought him down. They sent him to Alcatraz for a while, and then he sent him to Eastern State Penitentiary. If you've ever been to Eastern State Penitentiary, he has two jail cells put together to make a suite. He had a writing desk. He had a lounge chair. He had all the comforts of home. People, guards, in the middle of the night said that Al Capone was screaming and yelling, get away from me. And one of the people that were killed in there, among others, like I say, was Bugs Moran's brother-in-law. And it was thought that, I can't remember his name offhand, my mind's kind of fighting today, but it is said that he was screaming to this guy, he's screaming his name, "Hey, Jimmy, get away from me." And guards would come in and say, "What are you screaming about? There ain't nobody here." Even in the Lexington Hotel, before Capone was arrested, in his fifth floor suite, Capone would say that he would see a shimmering grayish blue silhouette show up. James Clark, that's the guy's name. Which was Bugs Moran's brother-in-law through marriage. And he would see this shimmering gray silhouette on the fifth floor where he had his suite. He literally bought out 2/3 of the Lexington Hotel. That's how much money he had. And eventually he started to tell his lieutenants and his guards, bodyguards, that, "Hey, can you watch over me tonight? Because I'm sure there's going to be an assassination attempt on me." And they didn't question. They just stayed there and they stayed up all night watching. But he was really scared to be by himself. And it was later that he said that he believed the ghost of James Clark was haunting him, not only there, but later on in Eastern State Penitentiary.
Yeah, and, that's a big story. I know.
about the that crazy one. Story at the end. I mean, you know, there was a power struggle for control of the Chicago mob. Some thought it was going to be Frank Nitti. Others thought it was going to be Paul the Waiter Rica. And Frank Nitti was called the Enforcer. Eventually, Nitti took over. They questioned Nitti about when Al Capone was going to be, you know, if he was ever going to be you know, released and would he ever get control of the mob again. And he says, Al's nuttier than a fruitcake. He was diagnosed with syphilis. He was dying. It was ravishing his mind. There's a picture of him in Florida in a robe on a lounge chair fishing out of a swimming pool. And then
he lost himself later in life.
And then later on, if you want to talk another ghost story real quick, Frank Nitti created his own ghost story. Frank Nitti and the mob was trying to extort Hollywood production companies like Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Columbia Pictures, and things like that. That was a way of making money. You know, protection money, they called it. And the FBI got a hold of that and was this time going to send Nitti up the river for a long, long time. And Nitti, he had just gotten married. He didn't want to lose control of the mob. So he dressed up in his best plain, best, you know, clothes, you know, nice jacket, walked from his home in Riverside along the Illinois Central train tracks and pulled the gun from his overcoat and put it to his head, pulled the trigger, and missed. He missed the first time. About that time, a train coming down the road, and he plinks off a couple of shots towards a train. Of course, they're ducking for cover and everything. Then he comes back again. He puts the gun up to his head again. This time, he blew his brains out. And it's right on, it used to be a Toys R Us. It's now called a Hobby Lobby in North Riverside. Right off of Harlem and that's an interesting thing in itself. Not only has Nitti or somebody has been seen dressed like Nitti in the style of the 1930s, 1940s, walking along the train tracks, tripping, falling, and hitting train tracks and then disappearing. But the interesting story is about Sirmak, Mayor Sirmak, City of Chicago, said that he was going to rid Capone and everybody, you know, out of this for sure, and you know Nitti in particular. So he had hired vigilantes out to try to kill Nitti. They shot him several times, but he didn't die. And you know Nitti was going to be back for revenge. So when Anton Sirmak was following on the coattails of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as he was running for re-election, an immigrant came out of his audience and began shooting towards the president. Now, the first thing out of Sirmak's mouth to the president was saying, "Hey, Mr. President, just like Chicago, huh?" He was too amused by that, and all of a sudden they discovered that Sirmak had been shot in the side, in the front here, just about where your kidneys are. And again, you know, the gentleman that was with him said, "Better you than me."
Yeah.
So he lingered for like 5 days, and finally died from that wound. And very unusual that Frank Nitti blew his brains out a block and a half south of Sirmak Road, named for Anton Sirmak.
Wow.
Isn't that a weird coincidence? When you get into the paranormal, you begin to see these, I almost call them synchronicities or really weird, weird, you know, things that seem to happen. Like Flight 191, you know, that one of the people in Flight 191 was Judith Wax. She just wrote a book called Starting in the Middle about middle-aged life. And on in on page 191 of the book, she describes her intense fear of flying in airplanes. And I watched
flight 191. Flight 191, and it's on page 191 of the book.
Yeah,
that's yeah.
This well, is, as my job required travel, I developed such a fear of flying that my body trembled from head to toe. And that's on page 191. Of course, that was also part of that documentary that I did for World's Most Unexplained. But when you do the research and you see these weird things, I mean, how impossible would it be for somebody to write about their fear of flying in airplanes on page 191 and the aircraft is 191?
Yeah,
how does that happen?
That's very strange. Oh, we're already a little past our hour mark, so you got anything to add, Joe? You got to talk to the mic.
No, I don't have anything right offhand. Not today.
Oh, okay.
Stay tuned. We got some more shows coming up next week. Friday one next week. Something about paranormal kicks cancer. We got a couple people in that group.
Yeah, that one should be pretty good too, because they do charity work as well to fight cancer.
Yes.
Yeah, well, for kids. It's kind of like St. Jude's.
And then don't forget to go to our website, which has been updated. Use the link there to subscribe to Paraflex, and you can watch all our shows there with all the bonus footage.
Not all of our shows. All of our shows that we've uploaded. Well, to
all the ones for Paraflex that we've done. And a lot of other great stuff up here as well. So, you got anything, Neil?
Well, let me just say a final thing that, basically we are going to be doing a lot of investigating this year as usual. I'm fully vaccinated now, so
mine will be on the 29th.
Since my vaccination, so I'm I feel a little bit more safer going out and doing things, but we are going to be going to Gettysburg again this year in early August, and I put together a spectacular trip because I have discovered so many things on the American Battlefield Trust YouTube channel about places and interesting coincidences again that took place on the battlefield, like some of the ones I talked about earlier, and we're going to be doing that. Hopefully, take a trip out to the Buddy Holly crash site in Lake, Iowa, and hopefully maybe do something either at Belixa Axe House or Noping Sanitarium up in Duluth, Minnesota, and maybe even a trip to Tennessee. So we got a lot of stuff planned, plus a lot of local things. And yeah, I'm still waiting for you guys to set up that thing for Bray Road.
Just going to say that. We are going to be getting hold of Lee now that it's warmer out and see what we can set up.
I'm definitely all in on that.
Yeah,
I am psyched to get my butt back out there and do it overnight with him.
We just saw Lee post a video. What was that now? We were just talking about this video.
It's an episode for a show that was done, and they were calling his place Wisconsin's Skinwalker Ranch. And I've got an interesting little tidbit on that one myself. If you want to stick around, I'll tell you. And
was that the one? Is that the one I shared with you guys called Paranormal Declassified?
No, this one was just
This is a different
himself.
Because that was interesting. They actually showed footprints in the snow, and all of a sudden the footprints just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Where did they go? Whatever it was it what the Beast of Bray Road? Was it a cryptid? Was it an interdimensional traveler? All of a sudden you see a footprint, and then the footprints stop. And snow around, there's no way for anybody to jump up in a tree. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. It's very strange.
Yeah.
Okay. So next week, stay safe. And remember, anything's possible. And thank you for coming again.
Yes, Dale. Thanks for coming and helping us out again, Bill.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime, guys.
You always got great stories, man.